Today, provide you with in-depth news and expert analysis, tell you the whole story and the bigger picture. Bring you the news you want to know only on Today.
Taliban says the U.S. is about to withdraw half of troops from Afghanistan. China's box office breaks single-day record on the first day of the Lunar New Year holiday. You're listening to Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Zhao Ying. Coming up, we'll have an hour of world news and analysis. To hear this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World News Analysis. A Taliban official said on Wednesday the United States had promised to withdraw half of its troops from Afghanistan by the end of April, but the U.S. military said no time frame had been set. Speaking on the sidelines of a meeting in Moscow between the Taliban and other prominent Afghan figures, the Taliban's deputy chief negotiator Abdul Salam Hanafi said American officials pledged the pullout will begin this month. The meeting sidestepped the Kabul government. No government officials were present in the talks. But Pentagon spokesman Army Colonel Rob Manning said the U.S. military had received no orders to begin withdrawing. The Moscow summit took place a week after the Taliban held separate talks with American negotiators in Qatar aimed at ending 17 years of fighting. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani was also not invited to the table in Doha. For more on this, we're now joined in the studio by Xu Qindo, our senior political analyst. So Qindo, what do you make of the contradictory between Taliban and the U.S. officials on the time frame of the withdrawal of American troops?
Well, there's a backtrack from the side of the Taliban. The spokesperson basically said that, you know, that's an idea, you know, both sides exchanged, but not part of the agreement, meaning the time frame of when the U.S. is going to pull out its troops from Afghanistan is not decided yet. But what really matters here is not the timetable, is the content. The content is the U.S. is and will, you know, pulling up its, to pull its troops out of this country. And that's important decision, let's say, important development, because it will impact on the peace and stability, will impact on the situation in Afghanistan, not only now, but predictably, the future operation of all different political forces, including Taliban and different warlords and the central government, you know, whether you know, the whole situation of Afghanistan, whether Afghanistan will see, say, a comeback of Taliban, whether the central government will be overthrown even in the future, that cannot be excluded.
So could you tell us more on what has been agreed between the negotiators from the U.S. and Taliban in their talks in Doha last week? And how do you see the significance of that?
Well, that's basically, you know, both sides agreed on a framework in principle, you know, and the framework basically for the U.S. The U.S. side has asked the Taliban to have a ceasefire, meaning the battlefields will be somehow, you know, have a pause. At the same time, the Taliban will agree to have a dialogue with the central government in Kabul. In exchange, the United States will withdraw its troops out of this country. But at the same time, the U.S. stresses very much about, you know, the Taliban should not allow its soil to be used by other terror groups, for example, Al-Qaeda or ISIS, to launch terror attacks against the United States and other countries, mostly U.S. allies. You know, many people suspect, and you know, the true or the priority of the United States is like, you know, following the America First principle. That is, as long as you don't attack us, you know, that's fine. So we will leave this country. But on the surface, of course, the U.S., you know, talked about dialogue between the two sides and the ceasefire in this country. But many people suspect that's only secondary to the United States.
Well, the U.S. declared war on Taliban 18 years ago. What do you think is behind its intention to offer peace to the same group now?
Well, remember, that's after in the 9/11 attack on 17, 18 years ago. So we know that at one point of time, there are 100,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. But after 17 years, and the situation remains a stalemate, the U.S. is not winning. On the contrary, the Taliban actually now controlled half of the territory of the country and one-third of the population. And they are demonstrating their ability to attack, at anywhere, basically everywhere of the country, including the capital city, Kabul. So you can say the U.S. obviously, in a sense, you'd question, what is the point of staying there for so long, because you are not winning, probably you are losing the situation. So right now, there are, for example, already over the past 17 years, 2,000 U.S. soldiers have lost their lives. 20,000 of them have suffered injuries. Basically, like every day, the U.S. is spending $45 billion U.S. dollars on Afghanistan. So for Donald Trump, he promised basically, as long as he got elected, he will pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. So now he's basically making that promise. Remember, just he gave the speech, the State of the Union address. He said that great nations do not fight forever, right? Fighting long wars over there. So I think that's part of his also political promise, that I will withdraw from faraway places and bring all the soldiers back at home.
What about the talks in Moscow? What do you think is Russia's reason for hosting these talks?
Well, these talks, as you mentioned in the beginning of the story, is between Taliban and the prominent Afghan figures, the very important politicians, mostly regional leaders, interestingly not from the central government. So, of course, the central government is not happy with that. Kabul issued a statement saying that, the ownership and the leadership of the political reconciliation process in Afghanistan is in Kabul, not in regional leaders or somebody else or by the Taliban, remember. So that's, I think, ostensibly on the surface, this conference was not organized by Russia. It was organized by Afghans living in Russia. And if you look at the site of the conference, that is called the President Hotel, the hotel itself is owned by Kremlin, by the government. And then, of course, as they said, that the Russian Foreign Ministry has given some technical support. We don't know what kind of support, but obviously Russia is playing a very important role in organizing this conference. Remember, Russia has been a very important player in the Afghanistan situation, and also, of course, in this region. Both countries are part of this Central Asian region, so they have important stake in the peace and stability in Afghanistan. But I think, just like the US, China, India, Russia, Pakistan, the surrounding countries of Afghanistan, all want to see peace and stability, reconciliation inside Afghanistan. Nobody and no countries like to see the comeback of, terror or terrorist group, somehow Afghanistan becoming a hotbed for terrorism. Everybody will suffer from that.
But what is the thinking behind inviting the former Afghan president Hamid Karzai and the delegation of the opposition figures while excluding the current government in Kabul?
Yeah, that is a problem. Of course, Karzai he himself is still a heavy political heavyweight, and he has some obviously still carries a lot of influence in Kabul and also in regional politics. So as long, during this the conference, basically the exchange of some ideas, Afghan side, the Taliban side basically said, yes, we agree to protect the fundamental rights of the citizens and also the rights of the women and Islam. Of course, people would question, what kind of human, women's rights you are going to protect, because, under Taliban's rule, schools for girls were closed and also women were constrained at home, basically. But this conference is basically some exchange of ideas, like what we are going to do. It's not, they are not targeting to reach agreement or treaty, which then will face a problem of implementation. And also the central government was left, aside. So that's not a good sign, let's say, because Taliban has refused to talk to Kabul. And it doesn't recognize Kabul. It calls North Kabul government as a puppet of the United States, as a puppet of the Western powers. So one of their conditions to talk to Kabul is foreign troops must leave Afghanistan. That's why the U.S. withdrawal is important, is critical to the reconciliation process, at least on the surface.
So do you feel any progress could be made in their peace talks without the Afghan government there?
Well, some reconciliation, I believe, that will be reached, and also more understanding, probably, like what kind of country we are going to have, whether we can narrow the differences between them. And for Taliban, Taliban is a conservative political bloc, let's say, and also militia. And it was listed as one of the terror-sponsored group, a terror group. But it was delisted by the United States a few years back. For the central government, it's still weak. It controls like two-thirds of the territory, population, but only half of the country. And also, its forces are not that capable to fight the war. Its professionalism is being questioned. So without the support of, NATO troops, U.S. troops, and many people would see there will be a difficult time for the central government to deal with the Taliban. And the idea is like, as long as there's talk, as long as there's dialogue, you know, the dialogue will help to narrow the differences, and then they will probably become, will reach a point at like establishing a power-sharing government. That would be the best for the country, but nobody is sure that it will happen.
Well, the Afghan President Ghani said he had spoken with the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who stressed the importance of ensuring the centrality of the Afghan government in the peace process. What does that tell about the America's stance on the Afghan issue?
I'm not sure that's because, you know, even Pompeo as Secretary of State has made that statement, remarks, but you are not sure how serious he is and whether he's able to put that kind of promise into practice. Because for the U.S., as I pointed out, the right now the priority for the Trump administration is really a face-saving exit strategy from this country, because, you know, it's embarrassing for them to acknowledge that there's a defeat and they are now cutting and run from Afghanistan. So they need some a cover, basically, a covered strategy saying that, oh, they are going to have a dialogue and the Kabul government will be the central, will be in the leadership to reach a reconciliation, to form a new government and to bring peace and stability to Afghanistan. But everybody knows it's very difficult because they have different ideology. The central government, you know, enjoys a lot of support from the international community. But for Taliban, they are basically alone, but they are very capable. They are very, vibrant in their attack and in their ideology. They enjoy the support of the people, whether you like it or not. But that's the reality. So it's very difficult to really, I would say, to reach the reconciliation and form a new government to say, and ultimately to bring some peace and stability to this country.
Well, as you said, the emerging U.S. deal with the Taliban is based on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. But once the U.S. troops leave, will that make Taliban a very dominant force in the country? And what will that mean for ISIS, which is seen by many as the real threat in the region because it is starting terrorist attacks not only in Afghanistan, in Syria, but also basically around the world?
That's right. There's no question that, you know, as long as U.S. troops, is withdrawing from this country, like half of these troops, that means like 7,000 of U.S. soldiers will be out of this country probably in a year and a half's time. And then you have 7,000 remaining that country. Of course, it's about the purpose of that remaining force or when the remaining force will also be out of this country. And there's Taliban force will become the dominant political force and also military force if NATO and U.S. troops leave this country. There's no question about that. And as long as for the ISIS, the relationship between ISIS and the Taliban, there are reports their relationship already soured because, you know, ISIS has captured all the attention worldwide. Somehow Taliban is living under the shadow of ISIS. So probably that's why, Taliban can make the promise, can afford to make the promise that they will not allow other troops to use their territory as a launch pad, basically, to attack other countries over there. But also, ISIS, you know, not only in Afghanistan, but also they have their new bases like in Nigeria, in Mali, in southern Philippines, in Indonesia, in the Middle East. They are still very much alive in different parts of the world. So the real threat, I would say, more or less remains alive over there. But Donald Trump has different idea from his from the conclusion by the internet intelligence community in the United States. So it's politics here, more or less. Yeah.
Thank you, Xu Qingzhou, our senior political analyst. Coming up, China's box office breaks single-day record on the first day of the Lunar New Year holiday. Stay with us.
With the great efforts made by the staff, today become one of the great platforms for policy debates and information dissemination. And I wish today have an even brighter and greater tomorrow.
Welcome back. You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. The Chinese film market saw more than $215 million in sales on the first day of the Lunar New Year holiday. This is a new one-day record for a single market in the world, breaking the previous record of $198 million in China on the second day of last year's Lunar New Year holiday. Over 15 films will squeeze into a tight theater schedule during the seven-day holiday. Insights anticipate ticket sales for the 2019 Spring Festival holiday to increase by 5 to 15%, making it a good beginning for the Chinese film market in the new year. For more on this, we are now joined on the line by Tong Jimon, Associate Professor of the American Studies at Beijing Foreign Studies University. Good evening. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So what is your overall impression on the new releases during this year's Spring Festival holiday?
Well, I feel excited, and in fact, I feel elated. Basically for the most recent release. As you can see, over the past 3 days, the Chinese New Year holidays, movie theaters once again proved to be the most popular place than ever to the country's reunited families with homegrown blockbusters, setting this a slew of box office records. And so I think that it's going to be a diverse market. It's going to be a very exciting holiday season. And also it's going to be, once again, another peak box office success in Chinese film history.
And what do you feel are the films that impress you most, stand out during the holiday?
Well, if you ask me about several of these major releases, I can name at least four of them right now, which are doing so great. And take, for example, The Wandering Earth, which is such a huge box office success, and I think that it's going to break the record in, for example, in this holiday season. And also Ning Hao's Crazy Aliens and Han Han's Sparatus, and also some of these major small productions like Integrity from Hong Kong. And these are all actually major components and competitive entities that are going to make this market exciting and full of action. But once again, I think that if we try again to re-evoke that very notion of Hou Sui Pian, the New Year film, I think there's plenty on tap that fills the bill for relaxation. For example, it's going to be very heartwarming and also very relaxing and sometimes even provocative. And if you look at The Wandering Earth, which is such a exciting, earth-saving Chinese sci-fi mystery by this very unknown filmmaker.
Yeah, actually, The Wandering Earth has attracted attention both at home and abroad for being China's first big-budget science fiction blockbuster. And some even say it's a science fiction movie that rivals Hollywood blockbusters like Interstellar and Gravity. So do you share the same feelings? And what impressed you most about this film?
I do. I mean, I do share the feeling. And I predict there will be this turnaround for the production. I think it's a dark horse in the season against the major trend, given to many of its merits and virtues. In fact, the same thing happened last year. If you look at Operation Red Sea, I mean, it lagged behind, but then it quickly catch up and became the major box office.
Yeah, it already topped the box office today.
Right, right. And so in the Wandering Earth case, once again, it manages to create this zeitgeist prevailing among cinephiles in this very country. And what impresses me most, first thing first, I think, is the plot. It is a plot appealing to the general audiences. It is a story, about storyline, weighs more than a star-studded cast, and it resonates with China's enthusiastic quest for a common community, for a community of shared future. And lastly, I think, special effect-wise, this is certainly, once again, to be measured against Hollywood ones, which set the standards and, in fact, making audience expectations high. Lastly, I think the name Liu Cixin must be mentioned, because the film is based on his novel of the same name. Mr. Liu is China's only award winner in sci-fi community, the Hugo Award. And so I think, once again, so the film will do well and will be, once again, the box office success in this very near future.
Well, last we know, China is a latecomer to the space exploration as well as the science fiction movies. So do you feel there's some kind of connection between the two? As many says, the film came as China is entering a new stage of space exploration. And as we know, China has just landed on the far side of the moon.
Yeah, absolutely. With the advances in China's major progress in advancing its science and technology, and especially with this very exciting landing on the other side of the moon, I mean, I think this is going to be a major source of inspiration for filmmakers in China to make similar films based on the heroic stories and also the heroic advances made by Chinese scientists and also the science community in general. And so filmmakers will quickly catch up and produce films that are politically and socially, culturally resonant with this great time in Chinese history. And so once again, I think that even if China is quickly catching up and Chinese filmmakers with mature technology and great storytelling techniques and also great cast, actors and actresses, China will produce more films along such similar lines.
And this will bring more confidence to the investors to try this genre in the future, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And once again, the investors now are actually beating up the drum in terms of creating more actions in this film community. And there are several reasons, I'm sure you know as I do. I mean, this great season of the Chinese New Year, and which basically would attract reunited families in both first-tier cities and second, even third-tier, and mostly, I think, third- and fourth-tier cities, in going to movie theaters, in joining these films, be it popcorn flicks, mindless or fun films. In The Wandering Earth, in this very great film, I see a new trend for investors, and that is basically films that are lacking substance will not have a market. And so investors should be attracted to this very market with an audience, with sophisticated audience, attracted by really substantial film plot, film stories that resonates with the contemporary Chinese society and culture, and especially China's vision offered to the world. We all know that this very notion of the community of shared future, and so this is quite an exciting time for filmmakers.
Well, I think we're seeing some new trends when it comes to the Chinese film market. For example, the screen expansion is slowing down after years of rapid growth, and the overseas investment is not as red hot as previous. And also, the Chinese audience's taste is also changing. So, very briefly, how do the world filmmakers, investors see all these when they decide to invest in a new project?
Well, the first advice perhaps is diversify your investment, diversify your money to different areas and the different, for example, different genre films. Genre films here in China are developing in a stunning and pace, at a stunning pace. And so in this sense, I think that look to your stories, look to the stories, look to the scripts, and look to scripts that resonates with the progress and development in Chinese contemporary society, and try to come up with stories, a film story, for example, that resonates with this very political and also cultural diversity. And so diversification is my first advice. And then secondly...
Unfortunately, we are running out of time. Thank you, Tong Jimeng, Associate Professor of American Studies at Beijing Foreign Studies University. You're listening to Today. Stay with us.
With the great efforts made by the staff, Today become one of the great platforms for policy debates and information dissemination. And I wish Today have an even brighter and greater tomorrow.
You're listening to Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Artificial intelligence is being increasingly rolled out from research labs to be used in our everyday business and lives, including kitchen appliances, education, and as far as the country's military capacity building. While these software-based innovations generally seem to be borderless, some say China is taking the lead in the application of AI. One person making this argument is Kai-Fu Li, a venture capitalist focusing on new technologies in China. Li is the author of the recently published book, AI Superpower, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. As a well-known computer scientist, Li argues in a book that China is better suited and should be teaching the United States about applications of AI, although historically the U.S. has been the leader in developing AI theories and techniques. So does Li has a point in his argument? Is everything about international competition when we talk about AI technologies? For these questions and more, my colleague Zhao Yan earlier spoke with Winston Wan, China head of the U.S. private equity from Shipstone Group Limited, Jeffrey Towson, professor of investment with Peking University, and Einar Tungen, author and columnist.
So, Jeffrey, first of all, Kai-Fu Li has released his book titled AI Superpower. It broadly compares artificial intelligence in China and the U.S. and is getting a lot of press. But what are the takeaways from his book?
Right. I mean, this has been kind of a pretty, you know, in terms of books, this is about as good as you can do in terms of releasing a book. It's pretty much everywhere over the last several months, which is pretty impressive, actually. And it has, you know, it has a lot to say about China AI and has a lot to say about U.S. AI, but I think the point is, what's the difference? How are they different? And who's going to be better at what? And he lays out a pretty simple graphic that the U.S. is better in terms of discovery, and China is better at implementation. And that may be more important. He just says, look, you know, you don't need cutting-edge AI to automate making a latte in a retail shop. What you need is really good entrepreneurs who work really fast. You need implementation, and that's what China's really good at. So he sort of points to that, his argument that this is China's age of implementation when it comes to AI. And it makes a pretty good argument for a lot of sectors. It's a less compelling argument when you start moving into things like diagnosing advanced disease. Well, then you actually do need cutting-edge AI, but, you know, driving trucks and things like that, it's actually not that complicated.
So, Winston, on Kai-Fu Li's arguments, what do you agree and what do you not agree with him?
Well, I think Kai-Fu has obviously made a very thorough survey of the landscape because he was actually a very good scientist and later on an investor in the VC field. So he pretty much met a lot of people there. On the description of the industry and the potential of this technology, I think he's right and I do agree. But he somehow portrayed an image of China that make people have some kind of free association and sometimes even a leap of imagination, as if China is a very has very cutting edge technology and is going to likely surpass the U.S. in many fronts. I think that jump of conclusion, there's a big leap there. If I think many people, whenever they associate, artificial intelligence, they somehow imagine a machine or a very powerful something that can do as good a job as humans or even better. I think that's probably a very, very long way to go. If you replace the word of artificial intelligence with just computer programming, and then you will feel that, it's just doing some tasks, and sometimes it's better and other times just a promise or it's a potential right now, and it's a long way to go to really realize what people have in their mind.
So Anna, so how would you describe the picture of the AI research, development or application around the world?
Well, quite frankly, it's a lot depends on human resources, and that's the country or the area that can actually attract those who have the talents is going to be the ultimate winner. I don't really see this as this old thing that, China isn't very creative. You start looking at 5G, China's way ahead. It's winning that war and that contest, however you want to put it. China's put a lot more money into this, $24 billion more than the U.S., when you start looking at the numbers and the people who are actually putting together, I don't think it's just implementation. I think China has things. If you start, has a lot of potential. You start looking at the patents in the U.S. and you start looking at those last names. A lot of them are Chinese, and as a result, if those people do not feel comfortable, for instance, in the U.S. because of the circumstances, they will come back to China. Now, remember, it's fine to talk about AI and, neural networks and different ways of computational values and things like that. Those are very application-specific, as Jeffrey Townsend had said. So what you really have to start looking at is how you're going to implement and who's going to be first. It's very, very important. China's on the cusp of implementing 5G down in Fangshan, just south of Fangtai. They're actually putting in their first 5G network. China has an advantage because they use the existing spectrum that was used by 2G and 4G. They can use the existing cell sites to do that, whereas in the U.S., they're going to have to put four times as many cell sites in just to do the same coverage because they're using a higher frequency that doesn't go as far. So there's going to be a cost benefit to China. And this system, because it works longer range, it can use existing sites, it's going to be much more operable across the spectrum, whether you're in Asia, Europe, Africa, or South America. It's a lot easier to use that. And that implementation and cost factor is going to be a big, big issue. So I think it's important to stop talking in terms of general that China's behind, the West is ahead, and things like that. This is a race. It's going to be determined by ideas. And I agree with the premise that this is a race about implementation at this point, but the one who implements first is going to be the one who wins.
So, Winston, one of the key points in Kai-Fu Lee's book is that government support could really accelerate AI in China. And China has released a plan for the AI development. The document set out a timeline for what China's AI sector should look like by the year 2020, 2025, and 2030. So how would you comment on the timeline? How far away are we from a world AI center mentioned in the document?
Well, I'm always skeptical about these kind of timelines. This is basically an assumption by government officials that as if they are able to control the process and plan it out. But if you look at the life of technology or a technological system, it's pretty much like a biological system. It has its own evolutionary process, which is very difficult to predict. You know, have we ever successfully predicted the evolution of life? No. And then I would say that the government probably could better spend their money in more ground-up things, such as laying out the infrastructure, such as putting money to educate younger people, and putting money to help people learn new skills if their jobs are displaced by the, you know, new AI robotics or whatever the technology there. So these are the areas where every cent of the money is better spent. I don't think a top-down approach ever works unless you are catching up with something that is well proven. But this is not the case. This is the frontier of the technology that no one knows where this is going. And then government comes in very heavy-handed with a large sum of money. I don't think that's going to work very well.
So Aina, what's your response to Winston's comments?
Well, I agree that it really is about education and attracting and holding the talents here that are creating the next wave. In terms of top-down support, I would tend to agree. It's not always the way it's going to work. You can't mandate or force march technological leaps forward. It really has to be something that's coming generically out of application-based knowledge. And what I mean by that is you have a problem, somebody solves it. As soon as they solve that, somebody is looking at it and seeing that there's an opportunity, and they'll come up with a separate solution. And you see this, and this is where China has been very, very strong. Look at the cell phone market and the number of, you know, the top 15, 12 of them are Chinese companies, and they're consistently battling. And that's why Huawei is winning this battle on the handset area. It's forced to come up with new iterations, things that the market wants, as opposed to things. So, yeah, I think the government's approach should be laying out the infrastructure, the intellectual infrastructure. But I don't. It's not wrong for them to be setting up the 5G networks that can use the AI. Remember, we're talking not just AI by itself means nothing unless you have data. And unless that data is real time, it's not going to be as useful. So that's where the 5G is. That's real time. But then you need the sensor array. There's a lot of information that's out there, but what's going to come in the future is going to depend on how that is developed. Do you have a smart car that can think for itself, the equivalent of a brain, or do you have dumb sensors which are giving you multiple streams of data that can be compared and then resolved? These are issues that the government has. But it's also, you know, there's a big benefit to China. The government is expecting 8 million jobs to be created by 2030 in this AI industry. And this is kind of this new economy that's coming forward. So, yes, there has to be new skills that are being taught to kids at school now so that they're ready and prepared not only to help the changes but also administrate this kind of new economy.
And Jeffrey, so both of the two guests talking about jobs, skills, and education, but is the talent shortage in AI business in China and around the world being exaggerated? And how to quickly train talents and improve the knowledge base of the industry workforce?
Right. I think this is one of the issues, you know, that Kai-Fu Lee did talk about in his book. That, I mean, he cites that there are three factors maybe that matter the most. One is data. The another would be sufficient algorithms that do the job reasonably well but don't have to be amazing. And then availability of basically engineers and knowledge workers who understand this space. Mm. And that seems to be the one you hear the most about, actually, in China. It's people looking for people. There's actually kind of a lot of data if you're the right company. Yeah, this is the idea of how many knowledge workers, how many AI engineers does China really need, and are we even close? And this might be one where I wouldn't call China top-down. I would call China top-down plus bottom-up, which I think might be superior than pure bottom-up in a lot of situations. You know, China did go on an educational top-down plan from 1999 to, you know, about 10 years, where they built more campuses than exist in the U.S. They can, if they choose to, start putting out these workers in huge numbers. They may not be the right quality at the beginning, but you can put the numbers. This sort of top-down thing can play out in infrastructure very well. It could probably play out in education. Maybe not in 18 months, but over 5 to 10 years, it sure can. And we've seen it happen. So, yeah, I think that's probably the thing that I hear most is we need people, we need the people.
The talent is crucial to a lot of, development of a lot of fields. But, Winston, I think both you and Jeffrey are investors. So what about the financial and investment side of the AI story? Is this a risky business, or does investment into the AI sector pose risks to the investors?
Well, it's always, various kind of risk, particularly when a new technology emerges. Then there, people sense there might be a huge opportunity to make a huge profit out of it. This happens when the steam engine, came into being. Thousands of people, thousands of companies rushed to that. It happened when the car industry came into being. Thousands of car makers in the U.S. in the 1920s. And the oil industry, it's the same thing. The internet industry, you've seen that a large amount of money, flood into that area, and thousands of companies get burned too. So that's just the nature of, that's just the human nature. So it would be, in my view, that it would be the same thing, and people will probably have to repeat the same mistake. This is a huge trial and error process, simply because we don't know what is the right answer. We will need to figure out, to understand keenly the needs, what the real problems are, the solutions, whether the solution is cost effective, is addressing the real pain point of the market, all these things. I think it takes really millions of people and millions of mistakes to get it addressed.
Mm-hmm. And so, Jeffrey, so what do you put into considerations when you assess the AI kind of related projects?
I mean, I'm mostly, almost entirely looking at healthcare, and healthcare tends to be a little bit of a slower world. A lot of regulations, a lot of, things don't, it's not the Wild West. Things happen in a more prudent manner. So it's a little easier than, say, retail or something like that. The technology, I don't think, is that hard to figure out in terms of what it can do and what it can't. I think it's harder to figure out, at least for me, what business model is going to really work and what new business models have we never seen before that are coming. I mean, nobody really understood software until Bill Gates kind of put it together. And search engines were a new animal. I mean, we're going to see business models that emerge that we haven't seen before. And that may be the biggest source of disruption for traditional business. It's just a different way of operating and making money as opposed to the new tools themselves. So that's kind of the question I think I struggle with most, is what does the business model look like when you have an AI-first hospital, an AI-first dialysis center? So that's kind of, someone once told me, it was in a book by Philip Fisher. He said, the adoption of technology by existing companies is as powerful as the sort of new companies that develop it. So it's across the board. It's not just the new companies that are rolling out. It's what all the incumbents are doing.
And so for the rise or development of the artificial intelligence, I also want to, talk with you guys about some moral issues, some social impact, because it's been suggested that in the next decade, more than 50% of jobs in the world will be replaced by AI. So, Anna, what kind of jobs can be particularly vulnerable to the AI competitors? And will AI be more competitive on the job market? Will it be more harder for human beings to get job, when you compete with an AI?
Well, that's always an interesting question. My grandmother worked very closely with the inventor of the electric and gas clothes dryer. And at the time, she was told that she was putting, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of washerwomen out of their jobs, and that there would be mass starvation in the United States among the lower class. things tend to evolve. We don't necessarily see where they're going to go, but there's going to be a different emphasis. Now, in terms of selecting business models, I think it's actually a lot simpler. You just have to look at if there's an efficiency that is captured there. Does it cost less money? Is there an added value to what you're implementing? If it is, then you're going to have something. Medical is a little bit more difficult because it's supply and demand. If you're dying, you want every opportunity to try to help yourself or those that are, somebody else is dying, those that you love. So it's not as elastic a kind of a demand is there. But to give you an example of something that's already working is that they're using AI in radiology. And it's much better at picking up abnormalities than an individual radiologist because they can compare, literally tens of millions of scans. And based on that, there are algorithms that separate out and they make very, very minute findings that would otherwise be missed. So, radiology is something that will probably go by, as will trucks. It's very difficult to get truckers. Taxi drivers, things like that. Cars could be a very, very big issue. Now, when you analyze that space, why would they do this? What's necessary? Are they trying to put people out of job? Absolutely not. But if you look at the million people a year who die in auto accidents, the amount of property damage that's done, the amount of money that goes into a car for safety features, all right, the time that is lost, the efficiency that would be created by less energy, better flow throughs, things like that. The time saved because you'll get where you need to go in an efficient and on time manner. You start to see that there's tremendous amounts of value that are locked up in that, and that's why these things will go forward. Not because it's cool or neat. Somebody can tell me, what I should wear with the the weather, but really these things that actually create value that can be recaptured, and then that money is going to be put in probably to more of a choice economy. We're already at that point where the vast majority of decisions we make about our money are about choice, whether we want to buy the expensive scarf or the lower cost one.
Mm. So, Winston, what do you think it will change our job market?
I think it's this is really one of the most tricky questions. They are obviously different school of thoughts. If you are in the optimist camp, you would always have a blind faith that there will be more job opportunities to be created by AI than the opportunities that it destroyed. But not everyone buys into the theory. And there is also could be the challenge that we may not be able to, as a society, to create as fast enough, job opportunities to supply and compensate for the jobs we might lose. So this is going to, in my view, that's the biggest challenge is the advancement of this technology could pose very big pressure on the political system. I am convinced that the current technology is able to produce enough to feed everyone. Actually, that's more than enough. Even the current agricultural productivity can actually feed everyone on Earth, but we are not able to. Still, people are dying of hunger. The problem is really on: are we able to evolve the political and the economic system in a way that we can cope with the pressure created by the technology changes? I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges ahead.
So, Jeffrey, so how would you evaluate the significance of the AI revolution we are seeing today? And how is it different from the previous technological revolutions?
I like the analogy of electricity, that it's, electricity was invented in the mid-1850s, but it really took hundreds of years for that to play out. I mean, it was started with light bulbs, very simple. Suddenly you get machines, suddenly you get factories, suddenly you get cars, suddenly you get plants. I mean, it led to everything, then you get computers. I like the analogy that AI may be that level of transformation, that we're at the light bulb stage right now, and we can't see the cars that are coming, let alone the computers that are coming one day. So in terms of its impact, it could keep going on for decades and decades, and be far beyond what any of us can imagine or even think of dreaming up right now. The part that bothers me is not the displacement of jobs, because I think we've seen that a couple times in the last 100 years. and every time it's been fine. The part that bothers me is that it turns out there's a lot of things human beings shouldn't do because we're not good at them. And, like, we should never be driving cars. Like, we're terrible at driving cars when you compare it to how well a computer can drive a car.
So we should have self-driving system already, right?
Well, like Elon Musk explained it in an interview. He said, you know, when you drive down the road, you're going 60 miles an hour, you see forward, you see a little bit to the left and right. For the car, one, it can see in 360 degrees, and from the car's perspective, the car is only moving at 1 mile an hour. That's how it views the road. So that's why it never hits anything, because it's going incredibly slowly for it. So it's like, we should never be driving cars. We should never be washing dishes. We should never, you know, we shouldn't be doing radiology. It's just better. We shouldn't spell check. You know, that part bothers me, that we are not top of the pyramid.
So, Winston, like what Elon Musk mentioned, a popular theory is that human beings will be threatened, enslaved, or even wiped out by AI. So what's your take? How should we, or should we prepare for that day? How will it change our human civilization?
Well, I think that's not the problem of artificial intelligence. This is almost, let me make an analogy. It's a knife. You have a knife. And you could use it to, you know, to cut the trees, to make your houses, to make your furniture, make life better. But you could also use it to kill people. So I think it's more about what humans, how we are going to manage human beings, and in a way to be able to control the behavior so that it will not lead a disastrous kind of application of artificial intelligence. So I think it's possible. Both sides are right, the optimist or the pessimist, because we could use it really to create a lot of good things. We don't want to do those repetitive kind of works. We don't want to do those kind of routine work. If it's replaced by AI, that's really great if we are able to find better work with the, you know, better paid. But if we are not able to do that, then this is going to be really bad. Like in the, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, and the cars, they are able to really remove a lot of the manual work from human beings. So that's a good thing. But I do agree with what Elon Musk is seriously worried is there could be the very dark side of humans. They could use AI to destroy human beings. Like we've already seen in a lot of these, you know, science fiction movies. You know, you have The Matrix, you have The Her, you have a number of those already laid out this possibility. So for us, I think the biggest challenge is we need a group of thinkers and policy makers to think really way ahead, to set boundaries, and so that people understand the consequences of the negative side.
So Aina, so do we need to find a way to coexist with the AI from now on, or even if you want, co-evolution?
Well, I don't think it's co-evolution. We're still in control. I agree with the premise that it can be used for good and bad. But, you know, let me give you an example. You know, Winston was saying that, we don't know. Well, actually, we do know a few things. For instance, world hunger could be greatly alleviated, because if you have all the data coming in from where there are crops growing and what kind of crops are growing there, and you have predictive weather patterns and things like that, you can estimate not only what crops should be grown, where they should be watered, how much fertilizer should be in there, but you can also make market analysis in terms of where the best places to ship things from and to, in order to answer the needs of people in those areas. So it could do away with a lot of duplication. It could change things. And those changes will have consequences, but people will be fed. And this is the kind of thing, that the reality that AI can bring. And these are the things you shouldn't be afraid of. You should be embracing them, because we're looking at a future where there's less human involvement, and we will have more time for leisure. And that leisure time will, as I said before, be consumed with making choices.
Winston Wong, Jeffrey Towson, and Einar Tungen speaking with my colleague Zhao Yan. That's all the time we have for this edition of Today. I'm Zhao Ying. Thank you so much for listening, and Happy New Year.